Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is Robert Crowther, Director of Communications at the Center for Science and Culture. I'm joined today by Professor of Biology, Dr. Ralph Silke. Dr. Silke went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine, finished his work for a PhD in microbiology in 1981. He's been a professor at the University of Wisconsin in Superior since 1989. In 2004, he was a visiting scholar in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the Stanford University Medical School, conducting research to further our understanding of evolution. Dr. Silke conducts lab research at the university that focuses on what can evolution really do. His main research interest has been in experimental evolution. His work has resulted in 7 presentations at regional or national scientific meetings since 2001 on the capabilities and limitations of evolution in producing new functions in bacteria. He is a co-author on 8 publications in such journals as Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, Journal of Bacteriology, and Molecular and General Genetics. And we wanted to have Dr. Silke on today to talk with us a little bit about his research in experimental evolution. Welcome, and thanks for being here, Dr. Silke.
Hello.
I know that you have a deep interest in evolution, obviously, and in understanding, I guess, its capabilities and limitations,
right. Mm-hmm.
Especially in regards to microevolution and macroevolution. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could briefly explain for our listeners what microevolution and macroevolution are.
Well, a short answer would be microevolution is something that can be observed, and macroevolution is something that has never been seen, but you would possibly infer it from a fossil record. So microevolution would be the sort of evolution of antibiotic resistance, evolution of resistance to pesticides that insects and plants develop. So it's the sort of thing that are actually very important issues, because people died because bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. Whereas macroevolution would be the larger things, and that's generally where the discussion on evolution comes out. It would be taking the large leaps, moving from a fish to an amphibian, or an amphibian to a reptile, or a reptile to a mammal, or possibly even some of the other steps that are going on. And in fact, the actual formation of a species, one species turning into another species, actually has never been observed. And it's the sort of thing that should be foundational to Darwinian evolution. But in fact, it's, to my knowledge, we have no direct evidence for that. We have never really seen it happen. So any of the other steps, producing new genera of organisms or new orders, for instance, an ancestral organism giving rise to, say, both the cat family and maybe the dog family, those would be macroevolution sort of things. So it's the big steps that we like to infer from the fossil record, but we never observed.
Right. Now, there are some scientists, Darwinists, and others out there that might say that microevolution, what basically it sounds like nobody really argues over, those smaller changes, are evidence for macroevolution. Isn't that right?
Well, I think the inference is if you can get there by taking little steps, if you take enough little steps, you can get a long way. And what intrigued me about this was when you just look at what you would need to make some substantial change, and it can be a fairly large change or even some smaller changes. For instance, if you had an amoeba turning into a sponge. Sponge is a multicellular mm-hmm. organism, and an amoeba is not. Or something, for instance, a fish turning into a reptile. If you look at, we know enough about fish now, and we know enough about reptiles, to to know all the changes that would have to take place and the number of changes that would you would think would have to take place at once, multiple changes that would have to take place. And in my mind, that's where the barrier to those sort of changes arises. You need too many things that would have to happen all at once because each one individually does nothing for the organism. One example that I use is bats. Bats sort of showed up unannounced in the fossil record 50 million years ago. There were no bats, and then all of a sudden there were bats in the fossil record. And the bats that showed up looked pretty much like the bats you would see outside tonight. Mm-hmm. And, well, one of the proposed ancestors is a tree shrew, a shrew that lives in trees. And a very simple example would be to say that, well, if a shrew turned into a bat, it would need long arms and probably light bones, and plus some skin in between those bones to make a wing and various other things. But
right.
if you imagine a long-armed shrew, that really is not going to do you any good. And probably having long arms is probably a disability to a shrew.
Uh-huh.
And certainly having light bones is a disadvantage unless you're flying. And so, but it's very difficult to conceive of a bat without having both of those. And so, and those are only two things you would need. So the fact that you need multiple things happening before you get the sort of advantages that you would want. This is why the jump from microevolution to macroevolution, it becomes just harder to swallow, harder to think that this would happen by natural processes.
Right. Now, I know that your research, as I understand it anyhow, kind of touches on a lot of these same things. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about some of the research you're involved in right now. I understand it has to do with experimental evolution. And how does that relate to this debate over microevolution and macroevolution?
Yeah. I really became interested in this when I read Michael Behe's Darwin's Black Box. And as an experimentalist and as someone who is trained in microbial genetics, when I read about irreducible complexity, the idea that multiple things having to happen before you produced any useful cellular machine, struck me that that was an eminently testable idea. You could get down to a very basic test of what a cell could do. Could a cell actually do? Could it evolve a new function if, in fact, two steps were required? And I knew as a microbiologist that microbes are well-suited for this. You can deal with populations well into the trillions with bacteria. So in a liter flask, you can easily get a trillion bacteria, and that's a large number. So you can ask if a trillion organisms can, from a population of a trillion organisms, whether a particular unique function can evolve. And then the other thing that inspired me was actually the work of a microbial evolutionist, I would call him, by the name of Richard Lenski at Michigan State University, who has been evolving bacteria for 40,000 generations, over 40,000 generations. He has 12 flasks, and they grow up every day, and 1% of the contents of that flask gets transferred to a new flask every day, and it turns out that that produces 6.64 generations of growth, and that's 6.64 generations where evolution can take place. And he's been doing that continuously since the late 1980s and has gotten over 40,000 generations. So I said, and when you get to those numbers, you can find out what happens in a fairly substantial number of generations. 40,000 generations in human terms would be a million years. So with bacteria, you can actually model large numbers, and you can model actually large amounts of generations.
How much evolution has he seen?
Well, not a whole lot. But the thing was, it wasn't, in my way of view, he wasn't asking particularly interesting questions. He was evolving them in a medium in which there was very little glucose, there was very little food. And these bacteria became much better at using that food. and so they evolved. He has sort of analyzed the genes that have changed, and he's able to produce most of the advantageous changes through changes that occurred in about five different genes. And so five different genes changed over the course of these 40,000 generations. And most of the evolution took place in the first 2,000 generations. He's been doing this since, like I said, the late 80s. Within the first 2 years, most of the increase in what we call fitness, how fast these microbes grow in this medium, happened in the first couple of years. And after that, it is only very, very slow increase, and sometimes up and sometimes down. So we did not see a lot of changes. He's looked at the DNA sequence of these strains after he looked at that after 20,000 generations and found extremely few changes, just sort of random changes that were in the genome. So the two-word answer to what he found was it became fit, but in terms of it was still very much E. coli. But I looked at that and I said, well, we could use this to ask a microbe to evolve something more interesting. And so that's where I got involved. So I deliberately gave the microbe the task of evolving a new function where I knew exactly how many changes were required. And because I had deliberately disabled the gene, and I knew that it needed exactly two changes to gain this new function. I've only gotten 2,000 generations and only about 1.5 trillion cells that I've tested. But so far, it appears that a requirement for two changes at once is essentially an evolution stopper. The microbe can't get beyond that barrier. Now, if each step of the way is advantageous, then a microbe can evolve as many changes as you want. If you have four or five steps leading to this new function and each step makes the bacteria better, then it'll work its way up. But from what I've seen, as soon as you require it to do two things, basically two things at once, it's an evolution stopper.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Now, you do all of this research in your own lab at the university,
yep.
Or how is that done?
It doesn't take much. My bacteria evolve in little test tubes. I have limited resources, so I'm only keeping two tubes evolving. And when I go in the morning, I or sometimes some of my students transfer a small amount from the tube from the night before into the tube from that day, and it grows. And you get 6.4 generations and 6.64. We periodically test them. If evolution were to happen in this situation, we'd know it because the bacteria grow, but not real well. If they were to evolve, the culture would become much, much more turbid. Hmm. Actually, we just hit 2,000 generations this summer, and so we're now at a point where we can look at the DNA sequence of the particular gene that's been the subject of this evolution. It's a gene that helps the bacteria make the amino acid tryptophan. And so now we're in a position where we can look at that DNA sequence and compare it to the original and basically see what's happened with it.
Well, I think that is really interesting, in part because we hear a lot in the media and from others out there that there really is no science going on that sort of challenges or looks at some of the challenges to evolution. And there's this idea that, you know, scientists just accept evolution and they're not really working on it. And yet here you are doing something that I think seems to, you know, go directly into challenging Darwinian evolution. Do you see it as a challenge, or how do you look at it in that regard?
Yeah, well, my stock phrase is I'm asking, what can evolution really do? And testing that by giving evolution a very specific molecular task and saying, well, can it do this or not? What I find interesting is, you know, I approached this question as a skeptic of evolution. I was skeptical as to whether it could do all that it needed to do. And what is interesting is these are not hard experiments, and they could have been done years ago. But unless you come with a skepticism about this process, you simply don't ask the question. You don't ask, what can evolution really do? If you're convinced that the answer is people and evolution professors and aardvarks and bats and things like that, that process can do all that. Why bother asking the question?
Right.
And so I think for the good of science, it's healthy to have people who are asking questions that a lot of people simply don't think are worth answering, but which I think are still very interesting questions. It's actually kind of amazing that, you know, getting a handle on a basic thing like can evolution do two things at once hasn't been answered this many years after Darwin. And, you know, that there hasn't been an intense effort to find the limits of evolution by the evolutionary community. And I think it's because they're all convinced already that it's true, so then you don't ask those questions.
Right. So this is actually good for the progress of science in general, in asking the hard questions and looking for the answers.
Yeah, it is. I think it is. I'd like more money to do it. Sometimes you have to do in small scale. It'd be great to do it in a larger scale. I sometimes would love to take over a Coors. Coors brewing vat and see what would happen with that number of bacteria, but you know, at this point I'm content to use the scale that I'm able to do where I am.
Well, that's great, and I appreciate your taking the time today to talk with us, and I know I've been really interested in this, and it's good to hear from a scientist about the work that he's doing, and I'm sure that our listeners will appreciate that as well.
Well, thank you.
If you'd like more information about the research that Dr. Silke is involved with and his approach to studying evolutionary theory, please visit the podcast homepage at intelligentdesign.podomatic.com. And you can also find more information on the debate over evolution at Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture homepage at discovery.org/CSC. I'm Robert Crowther for IDTF at the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.